Yes. All right. Welcome back to the Bible course, Book of Joshua. Tonight we are going to cover essentially the second half of the Book of Joshua. And the reason for that is a lot of it is a lot of it has to do with the division of the land in great detail that the Book of Joshua enumerates all of the borders, the cities of all of the different tribes. I'm not going to obviously go through all of that because you read the text, look at the maps, it's pretty self-explanatory. I'm going to focus on some specific things that are out of the ordinary as it relates to that. But first, we have some more battles to fight before we get there. So let's start with the northern conquest. If you remember last week, we went through the southern conquest. Today we're going through the northern conquest. And we'll talk about what that means, the northern conquest, because it's not as not as straightforward as it might sound. But first, if you look at the map, look inside of the handout, the first of the maps of today's handout. So we have the northern conquest. And here again we have Yavin, the king of Chatzar, who pulls together various different kings. As we spoke last time, this made the job for the Jews easier because their battles were being miraculously won. It made it easier for them than to have to go to each kingdom and conquer it. And it also allowed for them to be able to return to those kingdoms and find generally those kingdoms intact. There were specific instances where they were instructed to destroy those cities, as we read about Jericho, and as we'll read about the city of Chatzar in a moment. So again, if we look at the map for a moment, we'll look here, we'll see that Chatzar is pulling together the various different kings from all these different territories, Achshaf, Madon, Shimron, Dor, Kinros. And you see at the bottom of the map, you have Gilgal, which is Joshua's camp. And as the kings are preparing, Joshua does a preemptive strike and is successful at vanquishing the confederacy of these kings. And they are pursued, and ultimately the Jewish army is victorious. Now, one of the things we read about in this chapter is this idea where the Torah tells us here that God hardened the hearts of the enemy. It was Hashem's doing to harden, this is chapter 11, verse 20, for it was Hashem's doing to harden their hearts to battle Israel so that they would be completely destroyed, since they would not be pitied, and so that they would be annihilated. Sure.
Yesterday, at Kabbalah and Coffee, we talked about... No, it was Torah study last week. We talked about God hardening the hearts of Pharaoh. It's interesting, it's the same thing.
Yes. And the commentators draw the theological parallel from Pharaoh to here and asks the question, as I'm sure you discussed at that class, when you harden someone's heart, and then you punish them for it, it seems a little bit unjust. And there's a lot of different explanations. One of them that he gives here that I really liked was that when a person, the punishment for misdeed is that God can punish someone by striking them with illness, striking them with financial loss. The punishment is to take away their softness of heart. That is the punishment. So in this case, and really any punishment is intended to either correct a person's behavior, or if they haven't gotten the message, as a consequence for behavior. And in this case, it's a consequence for behavior. Because they didn't learn from the other kings and the victories that the Jewish people had over the other kings. And remember, the Jewish people were instructed to offer peace to all of these kingdoms, and none of them accepted that offer. So you're not getting the message. Well, I'm gonna take away your ability to soften your heart. In other words, your heart will be hardened, and therefore, you're gonna do things that are not wise. Part of the punishment for Pharaoh was the mockery that was made of him by his bad choices, where his advisors are saying to him, "Don't you see? We're done for. Why do you keep on making these bad decisions?" So, and in his mind, he said, "What do you mean? I'm the normal one here. You guys are not the, right." That the delusion is the punishment. So when you think you're actually normal and making normal decisions, when everybody else is laughing at you, you're off your rocker. You're just not getting the message. That itself is part of the punishment, the mockery that was made of him. So essentially, that's what's happening here.
So the hardening of the heart is also causing you to be irrational.
Correct. Yeah. That's the result. Now, we all suffer from that in our own way, because our body oftentimes tries to dominate our thinking and our spiritual inclination. So we're inside, we are saying, "Hey, wait, I shouldn't be doing this." The body says, no, it's good for you, enjoy it. And the soul is saying, no, this is not good. And when we give in, it's essentially, it's a mockery of us. Oftentimes it's internal and it only affects us, unless you get caught and it's in the papers, right? So then everybody else laughs at you, like, you're in a position of power and you can't even control yourself and keep your temptations in check. But that's all essentially the same property. But in this case, God turned down the volume on the sensibility of some of these kingdoms so that the Jewish people would be victorious, and as a punishment to them. Now, at the end of chapter 11, the Torah tells us, "Thus Joshua conquered the entire land according to all that Hashem said to Moses. Joshua gave it to Israel as an inheritance according to the tribal division, and the land rested from war." Now, there's a couple of things about here that are a little bit unclear. When we say the land rested from war and Joshua gave it to Israel as an inheritance, one might be led to believe that he actually conquered the entire land. So we have to really understand what's going on here. For that, let's look at the next map that we have here. Actually, let's skip to this map here. The one that says it's the third map or the fourth map. So let's explain a little bit. There are different opinions as to what is the biblical command when the Torah enumerates the borders of Israel? What does the Torah refer to? So we have one opinion, you'll follow along, that it's represented by the broken lines there. The other opinion is it's by the solid lines. But regardless, whether it's the broken lines or the solid lines, a couple of important things to recognize about this map is that the shaded area was not conquered at this point in the story here. And actually, not only was it not conquered in the story here, it is not conquered really ever. Let me stand corrected on that. Yes. The borders of the gray, all the shaded area all the way to the top, was not conquered ever.
We're on the fourth map.
There was a little bit of area that was not conquered at this time. Yeah. So actually, that may actually be correct. Give me one second here. Let me just double check something here. Chatzar. No, I think that is correct. I do believe, good evening. I do believe that the section north of everything on this map that is shaded on the northern part was not conquered ever. So even as we know today, this northern part is the Golan Heights, right? The Lebanon Mountains.
Yeah, that's the Golan Heights.
That's the Golan Heights, and that's the northern part of Israel, as we know it today, and biblically that's the same here.
And what about the area above the horizontal line?
So this is what we're saying is that this part of the map up here.
All of that.
So according to one opinion, it includes this. According to the other opinion, it just includes this.
Today, where is the Golan Heights extension?
That's it. It's right there. That's where it ends.
Yes.
So this area here, according to the Torah, again, whether it's till here or all the way to here, but it's definitely more than Israel was conquered by Joshua and more than was conquered in modern times. This is technically part of biblical Israel. So this was the part, this white area is the part that was conquered by Joshua at the point in this story. Okay, we're gonna add a little bit more, some of these gray areas, and despite all of that, the Torah tells us here that Joshua conquered the entire land according to all that Hashem said to Moses. That is not entirely 100%, I don't want to use the word, it's not accurate. It's not. It means that the kingdoms, there were 31 kings in the land, 31 kingdoms. Those kingdoms were conquered, and you have that on the map prior. 31 Canaanite kingdoms, right? These are the kingdoms that were in Israel at the time. These 31 kingdoms were conquered. So, within Israel itself, there were a number of cities that hadn't been conquered. You have the Gibeonites, which we mentioned, who coexisted, lived with the Jews. And there were others as well that remained in Israel, even as the Jewish people possessed the land. But this part of the story, which our tradition tells us transpired over 7 years, brings to end the first period, which is known as the 7 years of conquest. It's an important demarcation because there are certain mitzvahs that applied as soon as the Jewish people entered into the land. There are certain mitzvahs that went into effect after they conquered the land, before they divided the land. And there were certain mitzvahs that only went into effect after they divided the land as well. Now in chapter 12, the Torah in generalities recounts the victories of the Jews and the overall scope of what they conquered. And interestingly enough, it begins with the victories that took place before the Jewish people entered into the land, which is the lands of Og and Sichon. And the reason that that is included is because it's going to be a critical part of the division of the land, even though we already know from the Torah, from the book of five books of Moses, who was going to get that land, which is the 2.5 tribes, Reuven, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. Right? They were already getting their land on that side of the Jordan. But they didn't truly possess that land until the Jewish people were victorious. That was by their own commitment, that until the Jewish people are victorious and conquer the land and divide the land, their land doesn't become their possession. So now that we're getting ready to talk about the division of the land, therefore the Torah tells us, the book of Joshua tells us, that that was part of the overall conquering that took place. Another very interesting thing is that, and this opens up an opportunity to talk about something that we may take for granted today. So if you lived 500 years ago, and you wanted to study the book of Joshua, what would you study it from? Give me your best guess.
There was no Tanakh.
There was a Tanakh, but what format was it in? Okay, 1,000 years ago. Very good. A scroll. It would come from a scroll, right? The Dead Sea Scrolls were scrolls, and some of Tanakh was in there, and so on. But before they had printed books, they were written in a scroll, and there's a tradition for how the scrolls are written. And you'll notice that in your printed copy, we also have truck. We also have the musical notations for how one is to sing these. And it's not sung in the same tune as the Torah, as the five books of Moses. The books of the prophets, the books of scriptures have their own tune, most of which is not known. There are certain books that there are traditions regarding the books. But the format in how they are written is also tradition passed down from generation to generation. Now, why is that important? I don't know how it's written in your book, but if you look over here, here is how the kings of the the 31 kingdoms are written. So what's interesting about this is you have the king on one side, and on this side it says Echad, right? So such and such a king Echad, such and such a king Echad, the 31 kings. You know, one king, this king won, this king won, this king won, and so on. Right there it's just written straight. Okay. So, but this is how, now in the Talmud, this is called, these are called half bricks, and these are called whole bricks. The big space is called whole bricks, these are called half bricks. Now, sometimes, as we will read in this week's Torah portion, the book in the Song of the Sea, the bricks are stacked on top of each other, as bricks are supposed to be, right? Right? So the Talmud says you have a half brick on top of a whole brick, and so on and so forth. So it's built, scaffolded. But here it's not written that way. And we have one other instance where this is the same, and that is in the Megillah, the story of Purim, where we talk about the 10 sons of Haman. They're written exactly in the same way. It says ve'es, which means and. On one side, and on the other side, it has the 10 names of Haman. Ve'es, Pashandasa, Ve'es, Vayezasa, and so on. Back and forth. So what is the difference between bricks that are scaffolded like this and bricks that are not scaffolded like this? One is sustainable, and one is not sustainable. So what we have here is a set of bricks that doesn't have sustainability. And that's essentially a form of saying that evil does not have eternity to it, whereas holiness has eternity to it. A nice insight into something that you don't necessarily pick up just in reading the text. Okay, so we spoke about the northern conquest. We spoke about the 31 kingdoms. Put that one aside for a minute. Let's look for a moment at the other map, which has... it says Og, Ammon, and Moab, and Sichon, right? So you'll notice one of the easy ways that I always like to identify the border of Israel is the Kinneret, the Dead Sea, Jericho, and the Jordan River, right? So if you look along the left side there, you'll see the Dead Sea, Jordan River, and the Kinneret. So everything that we're looking at is to the east of that. Again, modern-day Israel follows along the Jordan River, and it's everything to the west of that. So to the east, these are the lands outside of the land of Israel that were conquered by Moses prior to his death, prior to the Jewish people entering into the land. These are the lands, as we'll see in a moment on the next map. You can actually pull up the next map, the one that has the breakdown here of the different tribes, and you'll see, if you kind of line them up, you'll see where the Dead Sea and the Kinneret are, and look, follow along, and you'll see that we have the division of the land, Reuven, Gad, and Manasseh. You see that? You getting that? Yep. So we have those 2.5 tribes who took their inheritance on the other side of the Jordan, and that's how you see it. Okay, so so that brings us to chapter 13. Chapter 13 begins with a recounting of the places that the Jewish people were not able to conquer or had not yet conquered at the time. And then the instructions from Joshua to identify the balance of the land, and to so there were seven tribes that had not yet received their inheritance. And Joshua, I'm sorry, I'm jumping the gun a little bit. So the land that had not yet been conquered. Yeah, so the first 14 verses delineate the places that the Jewish people were not able to conquer in this initial conquest. Then we begin to talk about the division of land on the other side of the Jordan. And what's interesting to note here is that there were two tribes that assumed their portions first. The one tribe on the other side of the Jordan and the one side in Israel proper. On the other side of the Jordan, it was Reuven, and in Israel proper, it was Judah, Yehuda. And why they were merited to receive their inheritance first is an interesting play on the word Kinaan. So right, Israel, before it was Eretz Yisrael, was called Eretz Kinaan. The root of that word comes from the word Hachna'ah, which means humility. One of the realities about life is that one of the hardest things for people to do is to acknowledge when they've done something wrong, to fess up, right? When you get called out for having done something wrong, to have a truly honest self-perspective and self-perception and say, you know what, you're right, it was wrong of me, I apologize. We have two instances in the Torah where we see from the 12 tribes where they recognize that they did something wrong. The first was with Reuven, when after Rachel died, Reuven went to defend the respect of his mother, and he put the bed of his mother, Leah, into Jacob's tent, where or was it Jacob's bed into the tent of Leah? I think it might have been Jacob's tent bed into the tent of Leah. So Jacob had moved his bed into the tent of the maidservant of Rachel, and Reuven felt like, you know, this is not honorable that my mother, you know, her whole life she had to play second fiddle to Rachel. Now that Rachel's gone, my mother should at least elevate her position. So she went and moved Jacob's bed. And it was a disrespectful act. The act itself was disrespectful, and it was in an extreme disrespect because it dealt with a place of intimacy that children have no business mixing in the context of their parents. And Reuven was called out on it, and he took responsibility for his actions and acknowledged that. Judah was another instance where Judah had relations with Tamar, who was his daughter-in-law that was waiting to marry the next son. So Judah had three sons, Er and Onan and Shelah. Tamar had married Er, and Er had sinned. So Tamar married Onan, as it's known in Hebrew as a levirate marriage, where if a man dies without having children, the wife is automatically designated to another brother. Now, they can be refused, but so Er dies, Onan marries Tamar, he too sins and he dies, and Jacob now feels like Shelah's too young, and if Tamar marries Shelah, or Shelah marries Tamar, there's opportunity for more loss. So he tells Tamar, you go home, we'll wait till Shelah grows up a little bit, and then we'll complete that marriage. In the meantime, the Torah tells a whole story how Judah's wife dies, and he's lonely, and he goes to visit his friend, and along the way he comes to a crossroads, and Tamar knew that Jacob was coming. The Medrash tells us that Tamar knew that she was destined to give birth to the offspring of Judah, and the fact that Judah wasn't giving her Shelah, she was under the impression that that was intentional, that he had no intention of giving her Shelah. So she needed to, so to speak, extract the seed from Judah, so she conceals herself as a woman of the street. Judah lies with her, she becomes pregnant, but because she's designated to Shelah by biblical law, she is considered an adulteress. So Judah says, he finds out she's pregnant, she should be burned. That's the punishment for adultery. Well, she says to Judah, she sends him the sign of the Judah had given her some a collateral that she would hold on to until he paid the bill, so to speak. And she sends these things, a signet ring, a staff, and he says, the person to whom these belong is the one who impregnated me. So she doesn't say, you're the one who did it. She gives him the opportunity to fess up. And Judah does. And again, we can get into a whole discussion another time why that became justified. But the bottom line is, Judah recognizes that she was right, acknowledges that, and in exchange for his humility, for fessing up, he too gets first dibs at the division of the land within Israel. So just again, a beautiful lesson in terms of when we begin, if we want to turn the land of Canaan into the land of Israel, if we want to turn a physical space into a holy space, it begins with our own self-development and recognizing our own shortcomings and being prepared to graduate from that and grow from level to level in self-perfection, which ultimately is equal to our relationship with God. In other words, the more we grow ourselves in becoming better people, the closer we become to Hashem. Now, how was the land divided? How did they actually divide the land? So, on the other side of the Jordan, where Reuven, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh inherited their land, it was divided by Moses in a non-miraculous way. It was designated based on the territory that God had instructed Moses. They get the land, and even though they hadn't inherited it yet, because that wasn't to happen until, as we mentioned earlier, until after the land of Israel was conquered, but nonetheless, the actual division of that land, who was going to get what portion, was apportioned already by Moses. The land in the land of Israel was divided in a different format. As we read about in this chapter, how Joshua instructed them to map out the land, and then he took the mapping of the land, and the Medrash tells us what he did was he identified each on a piece of parchment, each piece of land that was to be divided. So you have one bucket that has the division of the land, you know, each parcel named. In the other bucket, you have the names of the tribes. And you have the Urim V'Tumim. The Urim V'Tumim is the breastplate that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, wore. And on the Urim V'Tumim, there were letters that were illuminated. So, So the Urim V'Tumim the breastplate had 12 stones on it, and on the stones were the names of the tribes. And throughout the books of the prophets, we read how the Urim V'Tumim were consulted. Now, just to put it in context, the Urim V'Tumim were this folded over part of this apron that was worn by the high priest. Inside the pocket was a piece of parchment that had the name of God on there. What we call, I think, the ineffable name of God. And on the front of it were the 12 stones. And what would happen is the king, the prophet, the king of war, the anointed one of war, would come to the high priest, stand in front of the high priest, and ask a question of the Urim V'Tumim. And they would ask the Urim V'Tumim, and the answer would light up in the letters of the breastplate. So the letters of the stone. So here you had the Urim V'Tumim, exactly how it functioned in this context, I'm not 100% sure, but the Urim V'Tumim would illuminate and identify the names of the tribes and the portion of land that they would inherit. In addition to that, it says that the lottery itself spoke. So what they would do is they'd pull out a designated territory, and the paper would come out, the parchment would come out, and say, you know, Zevulun, for example, the name of a tribe. And they would mix it up again, and they would pull it out again, and it would say, you know, Akko, this is the inheritance for Zevulun. So you had kind of a double-check system where the breastplate would designate an inheritance to a particular tribe, and the lottery itself would miraculously call out which tribe it belonged to. Again, why the distinction between the land, the division of the land in Israel, which had all this miraculous events, whereas the land outside of Israel was kind of straightforward? As we mentioned last time, there obviously was a great distinction between the land in Israel and the land outside of Israel in terms of its holiness and its spiritual properties. And also so that there would, you know, beyond question that everything that was happening here was by divine instruction. Okay, then we go to Caleb. So Caleb tells us the following. In chapter 14, Caleb tells us, you are aware that which Hashem told Moses, the man of God, concerning me, this is verse 6, and concerning you in Kadesh Barnea. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of Hashem, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to survey the land, and I brought him back a report as it was in my heart. And then he continues and he says, and now behold, Hashem has kept me alive as he has said these 45 years from the time that Hashem spoke this word to Moses when Israel journeyed through the wilderness, and now I'm 85 years old today. So let's put this all in context. The Jewish people sent the spies in the second year after they left Egypt. So if Caleb is 40 years old at the time, and now he's 85, the punishment of the Jews in the desert was a total of 40 years in the desert. It wasn't 40 years from the spies, total of 40 years. So if he was 40 years old when the Jewish people went in, when the spies went into the land, so how old was he when they entered into the land 38 years later? Don't be afraid. 78. And if he's saying he's now 85 and now they're beginning the division of the land, so how long did it take to conquer the land? 7 years. This is one of the sources that we know that it took 7 years to conquer. So what happens then? So the 12 tribes, the 12 leaders go into the land, and it says that they traverse the land. Caleb went to pray in Hebron. He went to pray in Hebron. And his prayer was that he should not be convinced, he should not be consumed by the counsel of the spies. He understood that they were on a bad track, and he did not want to be seduced by their negative ideas. And he prayed at the Ma'aretz HaMachpelah, at the place where our forefathers and mothers are buried, that he should not be seduced by them. When they returned back to the Jewish people, the other tribes did not yet know that Caleb was not on board. So they began their tirade against Moses and against God and so on. And Caleb gets up and he says, "Do you think that this is all that Moses did for us?" So everybody thought that Caleb was going to join the criticism. And he says, "He took us out of Egypt, he split the sea, we were victorious," and so on and so forth. He gave us the Torah at Mount Sinai. So the Jewish people, Caleb is standing up for Moses and saying, if Moses was able to accomplish all of these things, Moses will be able to take us into the land. Unfortunately, the Jewish people didn't listen. And they cried nonetheless, and the Jewish people were punished. But at the time, Moses told Caleb that because he did not follow the counsel of the spies, and because he remained faithful to God, therefore he would receive the inheritance at the place where he prayed for salvation, which was Hebron. And now Caleb is coming forward together with his tribe saying, "I know you're going to, you know, divide the land, but I want to get the land that I'm deserving of getting because of the promise that Moses gave to me." Good. Any questions so far?
Where's Hebron on that map?
We can pull a different map where it'll actually be spelled out. If you go ahead a few maps to the Levite cities, which we're going to come to a little later, but go to the Levite cities, which I think is the last map you have there. It's to the west of the Dead Sea, right in the center, right there, right above that line that goes across. Okay, chapter 15, 16, and 17 enumerate in great detail the borders of Judah, of Yehuda, Menasha, and Ephraim. Now let's understand something. If you look at that map that has all the tribes, which tribe is conspicuously missing from here? I'll tell you the names of the tribes and you tell me who's missing. Reuven, Shimon, Levi.
Which map are you on?
I'm on this map, the one that has all the names of the tribes, okay? Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zevulun, Gad, Dan, Naphtali, Asher, and Binyamin. There's actually two tribes that I mentioned that are missing from here. One, Levi, no, Yehuda's there at the bottom. Levi's missing, good. Simeon, that's Shimon. We'll talk about Shimon in a minute, but he's there. The other one that's missing is Joseph. Now, Joseph's sons were Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, if you remember, back in the day, when Jacob came down to Egypt, prior to his passing, Joseph comes to bring his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, to Jacob for blessing. And Jacob switches his hands, right? And Joseph tries to correct him, and Jacob says, "No, this is the way it's supposed to be. Ephraim will have certain greatnesses over Manasseh," and so on and so forth. And he then tells him that Ephraim u'Menashe kiruvein v'shimon yuli. Ephraim and Menashe will be to me like Reuven and Shimon in terms of inheritance. That because you are special to me, and because they were born in my absence, and because they are these very unique children born in Egypt and still maintain their Jewish connection. So therefore, they will take your place in receiving their inheritance. And therefore, Manasseh and Ephraim each receive a separate inheritance in the land of Israel. Now, understand again, if you look at the division of land, it's very disproportionate. Some tribes got larger portions, some tribes got smaller portions. Again, all of this is by divine kind of transmission. It was not specifically about how numerous the tribe was. These were the nature of how these how the land was divided. Now, before the Torah goes, before the book of Joshua continues with the division of the rest of the land, it pauses in chapter 18 to give us a little bit of a perspective on what happened with the house of Hashem. So when the Jewish people came into Israel, they immediately, semi-permanently established the Ark. The Mishkan, the Tabernacle. Remember that throughout the 40 years in the desert, the Tabernacle moved every time they traveled. When the Jewish people came over into the land of Israel, Joshua set up camp in Gilgal. And when they set up camp, they also set up the Mishkan in a semi-permanent state. And it stayed fixed for 14 years. I'm not sure if it was 14 years. It was at least 7 years. It was sometime during this period of the division of the land. It could have been at the end of it, that it was relocated from Gilgal to Shiloh, And in Shiloh, it remained for 369 years. It was not destroyed. It was dismantled upon the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, the construction of the temple. So, what was different about Shiloh versus Gilgal and the time that it was in the desert was that the walls were permanent walls. The Mishkan was made up of atzei shittim, of independent panels that were joined together, and they could be removed in a moment's notice. When it came time to travel, they removed the curtains, these tapestries and skins that covered the ark. They would unplug the center beam, the center pole that would support the walls. They would disconnect the individual beams, load them up on the wagons, and they would be ready to journey. The walls of Shiloh were permanent. They couldn't be dismantled that easily. But we know, and we know that from the fact that we find in the book of Shmuel, in the book of Samuel, when they talk about going up to Shiloh, they talk about to the house of the Lord. So we know it to be somewhat of a house, somewhat of a permanent kind of structure. But we also find it referred to as the ohel, as the tent. So we have kind of a house dimension and a tent dimension. Tent manifesting this temporary state, whereas a house being a permanent state. The Rebbe has a beautiful talk about the different grades of elevation, from the Mishkan being completely earthy in nature, whereas the Shiloh, it being the walls are more permanent, whereas the skins that covered it were temporary, to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple, which was entirely a permanent structure with a proper ceiling, a proper roof, and so on. And there in Shiloh, what happened at that point was something very important that's going to come up later in the story, and that is that private altars are now banned. So the way it used to be, before the establishment of the Shiloh Mishkan, the Shiloh Temple, was that if you decided you wanted to bring an offering, you built an altar in your backyard and follow the rules of how an offering is brought, and you can bring an offering in your backyard. Once the Mishkan became permanently set up in Shiloh, private altars were now banned, prohibited. Now it's biblically prohibited to bring an offering other than in the place that is called the house of Hashem, in this place of the Mishkan. So then later in chapter 18 is when Joshua instructs them to map out the remaining part of the land and draws the lottery that introduces the subsequent chapters, that gives the breakdown, primarily in chapter 19, that gives the breakdown of the tribes of Shimon, Zebulun, Yisachar, Asher, Naphtali, and Dan. I want to focus specifically on two of the tribes of Shimon and Zebulun and Yisachar. And then we'll get to Levi. If you look at, as Raphael correctly pointed out, Shimon kind of seems to be just kind of lost inside the territory of Judah. So why doesn't Shimon have a little bit more of a some borders around his territory? And the answer is that Shimon actually did not have an exclusive territory that was contiguous. Shimon actually had multiple cities in the territory of Judah, kind of scattered around. The other one who had scattered cities was Levi. Now, Levi had scattered cities for a different reason, which we'll talk about in a moment. But both Shimon and Levi, at the end of the day, are there without having a contiguous piece of territory. Who remembers Shimon and Levi from the Torah, from the five books of Moses? Sorry? Shimon and Levi did something that Jacob wasn't very happy with. And they defended themselves in the name of the honor of their sister. So Dinah was kidnapped and raped by Shechem. And Shimon and Levi were appalled at that action and tricked the people of Shechem into thinking that they were going to allow Dinah to marry. And in turn, they had them all circumcise themselves. And in their moment of weakness, after their circumcision, Shimon and Levi went into Shechem and killed the entire city. When Jacob is blessing, giving instruction and blessing before his passing, he says, Shimon v'Levi klei chamas mecheresayim, that their art is the weapons of war. In other words, they're a hot-blooded group of people, and they acted very hastily and with cruelty, and therefore they're not going to have inheritance in the land of Israel in a way that would allow for them to, so to speak, gang up in any way against the other Jewish people. So although they received inheritance in land, they did not receive a specific territory that was contiguous. They had multiple cities spread around. Levi, as we'll talk in a moment, there was another dimension to that beyond just Jacob's instruction, but we'll hold that for a minute. The other tribes that I wanted to point out are Zebulun and Yisachar. If you look towards the top of the map, you'll see Zebulun and Yisachar right over here. And Zebulun and Yisachar are adjacent to each other. Zebulun and Yisachar had a very special relationship, also spoken about by Jacob, that established for all time a very unique relationship within the Jewish people. So Jacob says about Zebulun, L'chof yamim yishkon, he dwells close to the sea, and you'll see that part of Zebulun's territory is fairly close to the Mediterranean Sea. Now, why is that important? It's important if you have trade that requires the ocean. So Zebulun had trade that had to do with the ocean. Yisachar, the Torah calls him, Jacob calls him Yisachar Chamor Gorim. Yisachar is like a bone donkey. When you think of a donkey always kind of has his head down. And what do you do when you study Torah? You always got your head down. Right? So Yisachar were great Torah scholars, invested in Torah study. Zevulun was a businessman. And they had a partnership between them, and that was that Zevulun shared of his spiritual reward with Yisachar, and Yisachar shared of his Zevulun shared of his material reward with Yisachar. They supported the Torah scholars, and Yisachar shared of his spiritual reward with Zevulun. Now, you can't really make that trade. You can't say, okay, I'm not going to study Torah, and instead of studying Torah, I'm just going to pay off the scholars. And the scholars can't say, you know, that here's a part of my inheritance, my spiritual inheritance. But what that really means is a beautiful concept that's really fundamentally Jewish, and that is that when you support Torah scholars, when you support those in need, when you support institutions of Torah learning, and support institutions that spread the teachings of Torah and spread Judaism, that is your reward. That itself is your reward. The supporting, the act of kindness, the act of charity, essentially gives you reward as if you had done the work yourself. And that's why there's been an ancient practice for people who are in business, who are in the industry of making a living, to support their brethren that are in the industry of studying Torah and perpetuating Torah and Judaism in that fashion. And that exists until this very day. You can leave your contribution at the door. But seriously, that partnership is a partnership that exists until this very day. So let's go now to the next interesting division within the land of Israel. So we have, the Torah tells us that when the Jewish people enter into the land of Israel, they should designate cities of refuge. The cities, and the Torah elaborates on why we establish the cities of refuge. So you have three situations where this is a very, very broad description. You can have a situation where somebody is terribly negligent, and their negligence is what we call karav lemezit. It's close to being intentional. And their negligence is so close to being intentional that a city of refuge does not provide protection for them. So, for example, if you're dismantling a wall next to a thoroughfare where people are always found, you should have looked before you knocked down that wall. And the fact that you knocked down the wall while there's potentially people there and it killed someone, you're liable for that. We can't put you to death in court because there are no witnesses and testimony and warnings, but neither will the cities of refuge protect you because this is just gross negligence. Then you have the opposite extreme. The opposite extreme is something that is so random that it happened that it's almost a mistake. And that would be if you're knocking down a wall in a field that's been abandoned where people never pass through. Right? And you're doing it in the middle of the night where surely people don't cross. And it just happens to be that someone is there. That's really a genuine mistake. Then you have the in-between situation. And the in-between situation is when you're knocking down a wall where people usually aren't there. Like, let's say people are there during the day, but they're not there during the night. And you're knocking down the wall during the night. So that's a situation where maybe you should have looked twice, but you didn't. But you could have also assumed that it wouldn't have been a problem. It's not super negligent, but neither is it super not negligent. And we use that as kind of a platform to look at other situations that might bring about a similar kind of outcome where somebody got killed. The person who perpetuated that, who perpetrated that event, is the family of the one that got killed are called Goel Hadam. They're the redeemers of the blood of the one that got killed. And the person who killed the victim if he's outside of the cities of refuge, he is fair game for the family. And if the family kills him, they're innocent. So therefore, the Torah provides a city of refuge where the person can escape, and in the city of refuge, he is safe. The family is not allowed to come into the city of refuge. The city of refuge has all the amenities of a regular city, and that is where the person remains until the high priest dies. Now, the high priest can die that month. The high priest can die 10 years later, 40 years later. Whenever the high priest dies, that's when he is free to go, and that's when the family is no longer allowed to kill him. What does the high priest have to do with that? First of all, it's a biblical instruction. But the high priest represents peace and love. And as long as the high priest is alive, we consider it one era. And if this happened, so to speak, under the era of that high priest, so therefore, it's a deficient era of peace and love. But as soon as that high priest dies, there's a new era that opens, clean slate, and the person is allowed to go free, and the family is not allowed to kill him anymore. Now, the Torah talks about three sets of three cities. Three cities on one side of the Jordan, where Reuven, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh settled. There were three cities of refuge there. And as the Medrash says, quoted in the Talmud, that there were many murderers. There were a lot of murderers on that side of the Jordan. Exactly what that means, I'm not sure. But that's what it is. In the land of Israel, there were three cities of refuge that were designated. The cities of refuge, if you look at this map, are Hebron. There, you'll see them in the on the west of. I'm sorry. So you do have, it actually does outline them here. So you'll see on the east side, you have on that side of the Jordan, you have the Golan, Ramot Gilad, and Betzer. On the west, you have Hebron, Shechem, and Kedesh. Now, the reason why I'm sharing this with you a little bit, actually, it's not out of order, it's in the correct order. Now, if you look at the Levite cities, you'll notice that the Levite cities include these three cities as well. The Levites were given 48 cities, only 35 of them are shown here. But of the 35 that are shown, you'll see that Hebron, Shechem, and Kedesh are all listed here. So the cities of refuge were cities that were also given to the tribe of Levi. Levi was given 48 cities. The 48 cities that the tribe of that Levi was given. Remember, the tribe of Levi includes the Kohen family. At this stage, 13 of the cities were given to the Kohens exclusively, and the rest to the Levi family. There were more Levis than there were Kohens. That's, by the way, the way it is until this very day. There are more. We have a Kohen here, one, but we have, in those that attend on Shabbat, we actually have only one Kohen now. Thank you. And we have a couple of Levites. Most everybody is Yisrael, because Yisraels come from 11 tribes. The Kohen and Levites come from one tribe. So they will be proportionately, you know, I don't know if you took a census today, how many are, if that proportion still exists, but there are definitely fewer Kohens than Levites and so on. The Torah says that Levi does not get an inheritance in the land because Hashem hu nachalaso. Hashem is the inheritance of the Levi. And when we say Levi in this context, in this conversation, we mean Levi, the tribe of Levi. The Levites, the Levite family, the Levite tribe, was designated for service to Hashem. That is their inheritance. Their inheritance, what they inherited, is the opportunity to serve God in the temple, in the Mishkan, and so on, and to receive the gifts that the Jewish people are obligated to designate. Of their first wools, of their first fruit, of their first produce, the tithes, the portions of the animals and so on and so forth. All of this was obligated to be given to the Levi and Kohen families, and that is their inheritance, nonetheless, because they need a place to live. So the Torah does give them these 48 cities, and included in these 48 cities, every city was given a certain extension to the city of land for cultivating for produce. And these are the 48 cities that became the inheritance of the tribe of Levi, but not in the same way that the rest of the land was given as inheritance to the other tribes of Israel. And that brings us to chapter 22. Any questions? A lot of technical stuff here, but I'm trying to pepper it a little bit with some deeper, some flavor, so it's not too dry. So chapter 22, we find the tribes of Reuven and Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh essentially coming to receive farewell to return back home. They've kept their part of the deal, right? They made a promise to go before their brothers in battle and not to receive their inheritance until after the land was conquered and settled. And because at this point, the 7 years of dividing the land had come to an end. Oh, I failed to mention that the final three cities that will be divided, we're taught that that will happen in the Messianic era. So the final three cities will be divided in the Messianic era. The final three cities of refuge will take place in the Messianic era, which begs the obvious question, what do you need cities of refuge in a Messianic era? So the two answers, very, very generally, there are those that believe that in the Messianic era, there will still be some dimension of free choice and some dimension of death and so on and so forth. That's one opinion. The other opinion is that these cities of refuge will represent a higher spiritual transformation that will take place, that will be represented in those cities.
Just because you mentioned some element of free choice, I'm basically saying that in the Messianic era, if you are totally aligned with Hashem, then there's no free choice.
In that context, yeah. Yeah, it kind of like we spoke last time, a few times ago, about the dimension of a tzaddik. A tzaddik doesn't have free choice in choosing to do something wrong. Their free choice exists within spiritual accomplishment. And because within spiritual accomplishment there could be deficiency as well, there is a sense of what is murder? Murder is taking away life from something that you don't have the right to take life away from. So in a spiritual sense, if you're not growing as much as you can, you're squandering spiritual gifts that God has given you. That's a challenge. That's a negative. So there may be some dimension of that in the Messianic era. So back to the 2.5 tribes. So Joshua now gives them his final instruction. He's giving them, he's recognizing that they've done their part in going before the people and conquering the land, and now sending them back, he's reminding them about their obligation to remain faithful to God, to remain faithful to the Torah, and so on and so forth. Now, what happens is that they return, and upon their journey back, they stop. And they come to the region of the Jordan, and so here they're leaving from the west going to the east. And the Jordan, of course, is the line that delineates Israel proper and the portions of land that belong to these tribes. And what they do there is they go and they build an altar. And as they're constructing this altar, word gets back to the Jewish people that these 2.5 tribes have just returned. They're on their way home and they're building an altar. And the people are appalled. How could this be? Didn't we just establish that once the house of Hashem, the Mishkan, the temporary temple was permanently established in Shiloh and Shiloh, that personal altars are now prohibited? Why are they building this altar? So the Jewish people are appalled and they are ready to go and wage war against their brothers. And they send some representatives, Pinchas, who's the son of Elazar the Kohen, and others, to Gilla, to this place, heads of the tribes, and they come to them and they say, what is this terrible act that you guys are doing here? And their response is that God forbid, we are faithful to Hashem, we got the message, we're not building an altar to bring offerings, we're building an altar as a monument. The monument is designed for us to look up at this altar and to remember always that we must remain faithful to God, and that's what it's about. It's a statue. It's a monument. It's not intended to be a functioning altar. And they lent proof to that. Amongst the proof that they lent it is that they built this very, very large altar without access to the altar. Right? You need a staircase or a ramp or something to get up on the altar. So you have this massive altar that you can't get up on. It's obviously not intended for use. It's intended to be a monument for them to look at and remember what it's all about. The Jewish people accept that and remind them again of their obligations, and they return home. Joshua gathers the people, and in this section, he goes through, and it's quite fascinating if you read through it. Remember, we're also now coming to a close of another era. We read in Ethics of Our Fathers in Pirkei Avos, we say, Moshe kibol Torah miSinai. Moses received the Torah from Sinai, umasara li Yoshua, and passed it over to Joshua, v'Yoshua lizikenim, and Joshua passed it over to the elders. And the elders that lived with Joshua passed away within 3 decades after Joshua's passing. Uzikenim l'neviim, and the elders passed it on to the prophets. In the book of Judges, the judges are actually prophets, even though they belong to an era prior to what we call the era of the prophets, but they are all prophets. All of the judges, as we read, they communicated with God, God appears to them, and so on. That'll be our next round of classes. But clearly, they are prophets, prophesizing, and there is this communication that's taking place with them. But we have this closing of an era of Joshua going on to the elders, and not only that, but as we discussed at length at the beginning of the book of Joshua, Joshua is the reflection of Moses. And now it's moving from this kind of very special relationship between Joshua and Moses, and Joshua being, so, you know, it's like the people of the generation of Joshua looked at him, and they knew that these were the eyes that saw Moses. Right? These were the people. This is the person who experienced the Exodus. He represents Moses in their generation. The next generation can't say that anymore. The next generation is now talking about people who saw the person who saw Moses. But that's already, it's watered down. Doesn't have the same oomph. Again, modern day parallel. You know, you have a generation of people who lived with the Rebbe, you know, I grew up around the Rebbe. And then you have a whole new generation now that has been born in the last 23, 24 years since the Rebbe's passing. And they never saw the Rebbe. But they're hearing stories and are able to experience, and today we have the good fortune of having video and so on, obviously it's not the same, but they're hearing stories about people who lived with the Rebbe. And that experience is real. It's close enough to feel it. But what happens to the next generation? It's like we hear stories of the Baal Shem Tov, and they're inspiring. But the Baal Shem Tov lived a couple hundred years ago. The Rebbe just lived. So even if you didn't see the Rebbe, but you're hearing stories from people who experienced those stories, it's very real. Joshua's passing is the close of an era. And it's a close of, in a certain sense, of the Moses era. And therefore, prior to Joshua's passing, he recounts the miracles that transpired for the people. And obviously, it's not just for the purpose of recounting the miracles, but it's also instruction. Don't forget where you come from. Don't forget your history. Don't forget this. This is where you come from. This is who you are. And that brings us to the very end of the book of Joshua. Right prior, Joshua passes. And we read, very interesting, you would think that the book would end with the passing of Joshua. But it actually has two other pieces of information at the very end. Just before we get there. So Joshua writes a book of his events, of the events of his life. And he puts them into a place. And we seem to understand from the commentators that he hollowed out a rock and he places this rock near the entrance of the sanctuary. So it's some kind of, again, kind of embedded monument to the era of Joshua. Joshua sends everybody back to their inheritance. In other words, now that the land is divided, Joshua sends everybody to these places. And then Joshua passes at the age of 110 and is buried in his inheritance in the portion of Ephraim. Now, and in the last three verses, we read three interesting things. Number one, we're taught... Yeah.
Yesterday, we talked about Sarah's passing at the age of 100 year and 20 year and 70 years and the incredible significance
of how it's written, yes. Right.
Well, yes, of how it's written, and so here it's 110 years, and can you just remind us of the Kabbalistic significance of the 110?
So, yes, but that doesn't apply here.
Why not?
Because the Torah, when it delineates Sarah, the reason why we have such profound understanding of I'm sure that we can draw some parallels, but there's something unique about the way the Torah lists Sarah's years. It doesn't say 127 years. It says 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. And the reason why the Torah breaks that down is to teach us that each number there is significant unto its own. Here, if it was trying to teach us that significance, it would have said 100 years and 10 years.
But the only reason I mention that is it seems to me that in addition to that 127 also can have significance of, well, it's 1 plus 2 plus 7 is 10. It's a whole number is completeness.
Right.
And so here I'm thinking, okay, now you've got 10 and you've got 100. 100 itself is whole.
And 10 is whole. Sure. Correct. I haven't seen that specifically about Joshua. But parenthetically, Joshua actually was supposed to live 120 years like his teacher Moses. And he was actually punished because God found him lax in moving to divide the land. He didn't rush to do what he was supposed to do. In part because he knew that that would be the end of his life, that was the end of his mission, and therefore he was lax, and God instructed him, go and get this done. But he ultimately lost 10 years of his life because of that. That's our understanding of the commentators.
But it's interesting, of course, that he didn't lose just a couple of years. It was
a whole number.
I mean, a whole number.
Yeah.
It remains a whole number, like Moses is 120.
Yeah.
Moses is 110.
Yeah. True. Okay. So we have in verse 31, we have the passing of the elders that were taught about there, and again, why the Torah tells us about the elders here. Was to let us know that they were punished for not eulogizing Joshua. We don't find a eulogy here. And that was a punishment to them for not eulogizing Joshua. That they did not live long lives.
Any reason why they did not?
The reason that they did not eulogize Joshua is, if you look at the end of verse 31, the end of verse 30, and it tells us where Joshua was buried. He was buried in Mount Gaash. Gaash means to erupt. We don't find this mountain anywhere. The mountain erupted as a statement to the people. If you remember, Rachav, who was the woman who hid Kalev and Pinchas when they came to spy out the land, she was a woman of the night. And although she converted to Judaism, and our tradition tells us, as we discussed in the last time, that Joshua married her, the Jewish people never accepted that and always found fault with that. And they, so to speak, took it out on Joshua when he died by not eulogizing him. The mountain erupted as a God's statement that Joshua was righteous and his marriage to her was correct. And that was one of the reasons why they didn't eulogize him. 31 tells us about the bones of Joseph that were buried in Shechem. Joseph's, besides the fact that it's mentioned here, Joseph's grave is a place of great contention until this very day. Remember that in Shechem is what they call today on the West Bank. And it's a disputed territory, and it's constantly in conflict. And the Palestinians have many times desecrated Joseph's grave. So it's a place that has suffered a lot from desecration. Joseph, the Torah specifically mentions, because Joseph had a great sacrifice. And in that, he chose to remain in Egypt with the Jewish people, not to abandon them upon his death. And therefore, he was buried, or sunk, more accurately, in the bottom of the Nile. When the Jewish people left Egypt, they traveled with two arks, the Ark of God and the Ark of Joseph, constantly traveling. And again, I don't know, I looked in the commentators, it's unclear when this happened, whether this happened earlier on or only at this point. And at this point, does that mean the beginning of the 7 years of dividing, or at the end of the 7 years? It would make sense that they waited until they divided the land before they were able to bury Joseph properly, but whether it happened at the beginning or at the end of the 7 years, it surely doesn't strike me as obvious that they waited until after Joshua was buried to bury Joseph. There would have not been any obvious need for that, but I haven't seen it in any of the commentators. But be that as it may, the Torah is emphasizing and mentioning that Joseph, who had been sacrificed and lived with the Jews in Egypt, sacrificed for them by remaining in Egypt even after he died, was transported all the way to Israel and received his inheritance here as Jacob had promised him. Now, what's interesting about this verse is that who gets the credit for burying Joseph. It's the children of Israel. Who actually brought Joseph out of Egypt? Moses did. We learn a beautiful lesson from here that when multiple people participate in a mitzvah, the one who completes the mitzvah is the one who gets the credit for it. It doesn't mean that the other person doesn't get any value in it. But sometimes people get excited about taking on a project, and then their energy fizzles out. But there's always that person who completes the project. The one who completes the project is the one who gets the credit. So that even though Moses was involved in carrying Joseph's bones throughout the years in the desert, but it's this group of children of Israel who are credited not just for burying him, but they're called those that brought him up from Egypt. They get credit for the whole deal. And finally, we close out with the death of Eleazar, the son of Aaron. He was the priest, he was the Kohen of the time. He was the leader of the generation that was supposed to have eulogized, ought to have eulogized Joshua. And from the fact that he didn't, as a leader, step up to do that, that was the cause of his death. And his son, Pinchas, ben Eleazar, ben Aaron HaKohen, who we read about in the Torah, Pinchas was the one who is attributed with the burying Eleazar, and the land is given that we identify the Givat Pinchas, translated as the Knoll of Pinchas, is where Eleazar is buried, and that closes out the book of Joshua, closes out obviously a very, very important era in our history. The Jewish people are now in the land, and for the next hundreds of years, we're going to deal with the era of the prophets, the judges and the prophets, and we'll talk about the distinction between the judges and the prophets in the coming classes. But it's a new era where, and as we'll find throughout Jewish history, where the power, the leadership becomes diminished over time. The people who, despite their shortcomings in the desert, generally remain faithful to God. Now the temptation for idol worship and the turning away from God becomes a recurring event. And the tension where they're subject to the oppression of their neighbors, and this balance between oppression from neighbors, idol worship, judges and prophets putting them back on the straight and narrow, goes back and forth for the next many hundred years, hundreds of years, into the era of the Second Temple, the era of the kings, leading us all the way till the destruction of the First Temple. How's that?
Cool.
Questions or comments? Good.